have become members of a new race, overcoming petty prejudice, owing our ultimate allegiance not to nations, but to our fellow men within the human community.
We the ones who manifest the thoughts we ancestors birthed. Yeah, yeah.
You know.
Catty money.
What?
Them give me the torch we carry on the fire.
Oh, yeah.
Spirits of the people.
venerated for the gods and goddesses. Just long as it appears, so I can be homage and give respect to those who made it through the trials and tribulations. Adapt for education, violated people. We got the rulers of this nation. Marcus Garvey said, my black skin is not a badge of shame. I got the good hair, Africa in my face. Hesitant to love your features, you're out for your pain. We were taught to hate our looks, let me ride you again. My black is beautiful.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, corporate news media continue to report things like Israel's recent strike on the Gaza Strip that killed at least 19 people in an area designated a refuge for Palestinians. And they continue to include warnings of a possible wider war in the region. But there's little sense of urgency of something horrible happening that U.S. citizens could have a role in preventing. We'll talk about that with media critic, activist, and teacher Gregory Shupak. Also on the show, U.S. media have a similar another day, another tragedy outlook on gun violence. It happens, we're told, but all reporters need to do is quote people saying it's bad, yet oddly unavoidable, and they're done. We'll hear from Robert Spitzer, a historian of gun regulation and gun rights, about some spurious reasons behind the impasse on gun violence. That studied lack of urgent concern about human life, is that journalism? Why do the press corps need a constitutional amendment to protect their ability to speak if all they're going to say is, oh, well? That's coming up this week on Counterspin. The September 11th New York Times reports a fatal Israeli airstrike hitting part of the Gaza Strip that Israel had declared a humanitarian zone. On a separate matter, we read that Secretary of State Anthony Blinken rebuked Israel for the killing in the West Bank of 26-year-old U.S. human rights activist Ashnoor Ege. While it relayed terrible news, the Times story also contained the mealy-mouthing we're accustomed to. Blinken rebuked Israel's killing Ashnoor Ege, quote, after the Israeli military acknowledged that one of its soldiers had probably killed her unintentionally, close quote. People did dig with their bare hands through bomb craters in the dark to search for victims, but, quote, health officials in Gaza do not distinguish between civilians and combatants when reporting casualties, close quote. And while it notes that the UN and other rights organizations have said there is no safe place in Gaza, the Times repeats that, quote, Israel insists that it will go after militants wherever it believes them to be, close quote. What's happening in Gaza and the West Bank is horrific. The possibility of an expanded war in the Middle East is terrifying. But for elite U.S. news media, it's as though war in the Middle East and Palestinians being killed is such a comfortable story that there's no urgency in preventing the reality. Joining us now to talk about this is media critic, activist, and teacher Gregory Shupak. He teaches English and media studies at the University of Guelph-Humber in Toronto, and he's author of the book The Wrong Story, Palestine, Israel, and the Media from OR Books. He joins us now by phone. Welcome back to Counterspin, Gregory Shupak.
Hi, how are you?
So the New York Times, September 10th, had a story about how health workers are trying to vaccinate children in northern Gaza against polio, but supplies of fuel and medicine are being obstructed by Israeli forces, including one convoy of UN groups that was held at gunpoint for 8 hours. So the meat of the Times story is here. Quote, the Israeli military said in a statement that it had intelligence suggesting that there were Palestinian suspects with the convoy, but did not say what they were suspected of doing. In another statement on Tuesday, it said that Israeli security forces questioned the suspects in the field and then released them. The episode highlighted the challenges facing humanitarian efforts like the vaccination campaign and what UN officials say is increasing Israeli obstruction of aid deliveries to Gaza, close quote. So Israel holds up a humanitarian group at gunpoint for 8 hours, and they don't offer anything resembling a reason. And the upshot is this highlights challenges. UN officials say that this is an obstruction of aid. Knowing reporters, we know that some of them are saying, look how we pushed back against Israel here. We said they couldn't say what the suspects were suspected of. But it doesn't read as brave challenging of the powerful to a reader. And of course, we know that that language is a choice, right? So what are you making of media coverage right now?
Two main observations come to mind. not specifically with regard to the story you're talking about, although that does continue, as you said, the longer-term trends of this kind of mealy-mouth refusal to just report what has flatly and plainly and obviously happened and who's responsible for it. But setting that aside, I would note a couple of other things that have troubled me. One is that I think so much of the Palestinian issue right now has just been kind of metabolized into U.S. election coverage, so that
right.
most of what the public is getting on the issue is how is the political theater going to be affected by the fact that a genocide is occurring in which the U.S. is a direct participant, rather than more urgent questions such as how can this genocide be immediately stopped? So I think that that's a real case of focusing on the wrong question. I think likewise that you get some attention to, well, how, you know, is the Harris campaign going to suffer because the Biden administration, of which she's a part, has alienated so many Arab and or Muslim voters in the United States because of the Gaza genocide. Again, that just kind of reduces the Palestinians and their supporters amongst Arabs and Muslims, not to say nothing of many other segments of American society that do support Palestinians to one extent or another. They're just here reduced to kind of, well, how's this going to factor into the electoral calculation?
Right.
And so that, I think, is, again, really not at all adequate to the challenge of responding to one of the worst series of massacres that we've seen since World War II. In fact, the UN Special Rapporteur on Food just the other day said that this is the worst campaign of deliberate starvation since World War II. So just treating this as like a subset of U.S. domestic politics is not proportional to the severity of what's unfolding. The second observation I was going to make is that I think to a really, really depressing extent, the mass murder of Palestinians, the mass starvation of Palestinians, the total destruction of essentially every structure in Gaza by this point, it's becoming kind of a dog bites man story, in that it's just become, and I hate to use the word normalized because I think it's totally overused these days, but this is sort of a case study where it's barely even newsworthy that really just shocking atrocities are happening day by day. So, I mean, last week, Israel bombed a shelter within the compound of the Al-Aqsa Hospital, I believe it's Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in Deir al-Balah, and this has, as far as I can tell, effectively zero coverage in major English language, American or Western media broadly. But again, right. that is a real travesty to just allow this to not be a leading story every day because it keeps happening. In fact, the fact that it keeps happening ought to be in itself proof of how dire and urgent these matters are.
You wrote for Electronic Intifada back in July about how even after credible source after credible source confirms that Israel is carrying out a genocide against Palestinians, you said we find ourselves living through a mass public genocide denial. And without at all trying to be coy, I wonder, are we now at acceptance?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now it's just kind of a factor. And I wrote down dog bites man because it very much gives that feeling of, oh, well, these folks are at war with one another. That's just kind of a normal story.
Yeah. And first of all, genocide can and should never be just a normal story.
No.
But that is very much what it's being treated like. And second of all, it's also not, right? I mean, it's kind of like, yes, brutal, violent oppression of Palestinians has been the case since Israel came into existence in 1948. And in fact, in the years leading up to it, there were certainly steps taken to create the conditions for Israel. So it is a decades-old story, but there is a kind of hand-waving that creeps into public discourse and I think does underlie some of this lack of attention to what continues to happen in Gaza and the West Bank. In reality, this is a very modern conflict, right? It's a U.S. brokered settler colonial insurgency, counterinsurgency. It's got very little to do with religion and everything to do with geopolitics and capitalism and colonialism. But it's easier to just sort of treat it as, oh, well, these backward savage barbarians and their ancient inscrutable blood feuds are just doing what they have always done and always will. So that's not worthy of our attention. But that, aside from being wildly inaccurate, just enables the slaughter and dispossession, as well as resistance to it, to continue.
Finally, to promote the idea or to support the idea that this genocide is kind of okay or par for the course anyway, and that protesting it is misguided or worse, that requires mental gymnastics, including charges of anti-Semitism against Jewish people.
Yeah.
Jewish people are leaders in the opposition to Israel's actions, including on college campuses. And I would encourage folks to read Carrie Zaremba's piece on Mondo Weiss about the lengths that university administrators are going to right now to crack down on and impossibilize dissent and political expression. But the point is, we still see the dissent. So even the problems that we're talking about, that media are sort of ratifying and pushing out day after day, people are seeing through them, and there is dissent. And I just wonder what your thoughts are in terms of, maybe not to use the word hope, but where do you see the resistance happening? You're a college professor.
Certainly on campuses and many other places as well. Labor organization, we have a coalition here called Labor for Palestine, and I know there are similar, you know, outfits in the United States and other parts of the world, religious organizations of all sorts, Christian, Muslim, Jewish, likely others as well. I would, in addition, say that certainly in terms of just getting out analysis and information, then one of the very few kind of advantages or bright spots that we have, I think, now as compared to the past, is that it is easier for independent sources like FAIR, Electronic Intifada, Mondo Weiss, and others to circulate quickly to wide audiences. And that, I think, has been a big reason why the Palestinian counter-narrative has been able to puncture, I think, the public consciousness more so than it could in the past. I think it's totally the independent educational efforts by the Palestine Solidarity Movement that has done that. And one major tool at their, or perhaps I will dare say our, disposal is independent media, because this is where you're getting much more information, much more accurate information, and much more rigorous analysis than the sort of fluff and pablum that you get on the editorial pages of the New York Times or Washington Post, much less the blood-curdling racism you get on the Wall Street Journal and its editorial pages. So I think that this era does have one serious advantage, and that's that outlets like those that I've mentioned have a much greater capacity to reach people who might not otherwise be exposed to this anti-Zionist narrative.
We've been speaking with Gregory Shupak. He teaches English and Media Studies at the University of Guelph-Humber. And his book, The Wrong Story, Palestine, Israel, and the Media, is still out now from OR Books. Greg Shupak, thanks so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
Our guest began a piece for Time magazine, quote, "Soon after these fearsome weapons began to circulate in society, they developed a notorious reputation. Developed for the battlefield, these guns in civilian hands became the tools of choice in gruesome, highly publicized shootings. Calls for their restriction or banishment escalated, and state legislatures moved to enact new laws." Close quote. The kicker is that he's talking about the 1920s and the Tommy gun, the Thompson machine gun. Today's opponents of efforts to quell gun violence with regulation often hand wave toward U.S. history, the Founding Fathers, the Second Amendment, to bolster their case. And that can be persuasive if it's unchecked. Checking it is what Robert Spitzer does. He's adjunct professor at College of William and Mary School of Law and professor emeritus of political science at SUNY Cortland. He's the author of numerous books, including most recently The Gun Dilemma from Oxford University Press. He joins us now by phone from Williamsburg, Virginia. Welcome to Counterspin, Robert Spitzer.
Good to speak with you.
Dispelling myths about the history of guns is important at any time, but it's crucial right now as the Supreme Court has explicitly inserted historicity into our ability to make decisions about the place guns have in society. Can I ask you to explain the 2022 Bruin decision and your reaction to it? What should folks know?
The 2022 Supreme Court Bruin decision was extremely important, and for a couple of reasons. The first was that it expanded the definition of Second Amendment rights, saying that average people now had a Second Amendment right to carry guns with them out in society for personal self-protection. The other big point from the Bruin decision was that the Supreme Court recast the basis for judging the constitutionality of modern gun laws, and the new standard is that they have to be grounded in some kind of historical tradition of regulating weapons. So lawyers, historians, and others have been scrambling since 2022 to examine old gun laws to try and see if there are analogs or similar laws that compare to modern firearms laws to try and justify and support the constitutionality of those modern laws. Now, as far as I'm concerned, the decision is a terrible decision, in part because it's ahistorical. For example, weapons carrying was widely regulated, restricted, and even barred in early America. In fact, from the 1600s to the start of the 20th century, every single state in the Union had restrictions against the concealed carrying of dangerous weapons, including but not limited to handguns or pistols. So to say that that is now protected under the Second Amendment based on a reading of history has history upside down. Moreover, this history standard is riddled with a vagueness, and it has opened the door to not only a flood of challenges of existing gun laws, laws that had been accepted without question before 2022, but it has also led to contrary conclusions where judges in one place will decide that historically analogous laws do support the constitutionality of a modern law, and other judges ruling the exact opposite.
Well, so there's no need to automatically exalt any resort to history, as I think you've said, when we know the time in which it was forged. But in the case of guns, if I can just draw you out, it doesn't even square, because as your work explains, gun rights have always been paired with regulations. Talk a little more about that.
Many people think that in the old days, in the early decades and centuries of the country's founding, that everyone owned guns, that everybody was skilled in the use of guns, or at least adult white men, and that there were no gun restrictions or weapons restrictions to speak of until you get into the 20th century. And really, my research is found and demonstrated that the opposite is true. In many respects, firearms and other weapons were regulated more strictly in the country's first 300 years than in the last 30 years. From the 1600s, 1700s through the 1800s, states, colonies, and localities enacted literally thousands of weapons laws of every imaginable variety. I mean, you would be hard-pressed to come up with a gun regulation idea today that didn't exist 100, 150, 200 years ago. I mean, today in America's politicized environment, we view, or the antagonists in the gun debate view, a gain for one side as a loss for the other, what they call a zero-sum game. But that was not how gun rights and gun rules were thought of in most of our history. The two were perfectly compatible. Sure, you'd have clashes at times, but they did not pose the kind of polarizing political paralysis in terms of the gun issue that seems to exist today.
maybe you've answered this, but as a researcher on the actual history of gun restrictions existing alongside the ability to own guns, what role do you see misinformation or misunderstanding playing in this country's evident inability to take meaningful steps? And how could media or journalists help in that regard?
Well, I think there is considerable misunderstanding about our own past and the very idea that you might impose regulations on dangerous weapons doesn't mean that you're eliminating them entirely. It means that the government is doing the most important job that any government has, which is to protect the lives, health, and safety of its people. I mean, that's the single most important purpose of government. And of course, in a democratic society, you want to protect and guarantee individual rights and freedoms and the rest. But the idea that these two are mutually exclusive when it comes to gun laws is just a fallacy. And I think that news coverage, and I will say, I think news coverage has gotten better in terms of reporting the knowledge that people have gained regarding our own gun past, mm-hmm. is to try and set aside the old kind of Wild West image of our frontier. Certainly it was an untamed piece of geography and period of time, but far more people, you know, if you think of the West of the 19th century, far more people died from disease, died from accidents, died from malnutrition than ever died from guns, frankly. And there were far, far, far fewer actual gunfights in the Wild West than is depicted or has been depicted in popular culture. So it's important to set aside the popular culture imagery of our historical past, whether it's the colonial era or the 19th century Western lands, and understand that not only were guns strictly regulated, as I mentioned, every state in the country had restrictions on the concealed carrying of weapons by the start of the 20th century, but those weapons not only included guns, but also included knives and clubs. Over 40 states, for example, had restrictions on the books regarding what were called Bowie knives, the sort of famous large-bladed knife named after the adventurer Jim Bowie. And the idea that knives of a class called fighting knives, the idea that over 40 states restricted those things, is one indication that public safety was indeed a top concern, and our forefathers and foremothers well recognized and understood that dangerous weapons were dangerous and that you were not depriving people of rights if you regulated them, restricted them, and imposed laws pertaining to, let's say, the time, place, and manner for carrying weapons or other kinds of restrictions.
Well, maybe it follows naturally, but finally, listeners may know of the recent statement from the U.S. Surgeon General declaring gun violence a public health crisis in recognition of the impacts of gun violence beyond those that are killed, to the wounded, to the families, to the communities, to mental and emotional health. That whole framing is very much at odds with the ownership conversation about individual rights. Can I ask you finally, do you see ways forward that engage all of this, or are we on maybe separate but complementary tracks in terms of concrete ways forward? What would you like to see?
I think there are a number of ways forward, and I would note at the outset that I think the public health and medical communities have contributed significantly and important knowledge and research about the consequences of guns and violence. Guns are uniquely destructive. They wreak more havoc on the body than any other interpersonal weapon. Any surgeon could tell you that. The people who staff emergency rooms could tell you that. It is a public health problem, crisis, and I think it's appropriate and beneficial that those communities have become involved in writing about, researching, and talking about the public health consequences, adverse consequences of prolific firearms. Beyond that, there are many public policy alternatives that demonstrably and measurably can reduce and have reduced in places where they existed gun harm, gun violence. And most people have heard of things like red flag laws or universal background checks or licensing schemes and other kinds of laws. Some states have those, some states don't. What is needed most, of course, is for the federal government to act more aggressively with respect to those or other gun policy areas. And that's been extremely difficult because of the very close competition between the Republicans and Democrats at the national level in Congress and in the presidency. But the states that have adopted stricter laws with respect to guns and gun violence have lower crime rates, lower suicide rates, lower homicide rates than states that have not adopted those sorts of measures. So we know they can make a difference. Yes, there are a great many guns in America. There are more guns than Americans, but most of them are owned by a minority of the country. That is, not every home in America has a gun, far from it. And the average gun owner wants to do the right thing and the responsible thing. And when you talk to gun owners and get past their instinctive suspicion of the phrase gun control or gun policy and talk about, well, what do you think should be the public policy? What you find is that most gun owners actually support most of the policy ideas to restrict and reduce gun harm that we are talking about in society today. So I think that all suggests some positive and constructive ways that the country can move forward.
All right, then. We've been speaking with Robert Spitzer of William & Mary School of Law and SUNY Cortland. The Gun Dilemma is out now from Oxford University Press, and the 9th edition of his book, The Politics of Gun Control, is out this year from Routledge. Thank you so much, Robert Spitzer, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
My pleasure.
And that's it for Counterspin this week. Counterspin is produced by the National Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. If you're interested in previous shows or FAIR's broader work, you can find out about that on FAIR.org. And the website is also the place to show much needed support for the show, if you are able and so inclined. The show is engineered by Riley Baer. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
This is a show called Viva La Mock. Those things hold true. If it's not a Friday night, you're listening to an encore presentation. However, you've just tuned in at the best part of this encore presentation. Or regular show, again, if you're listening on a Friday night. Because it's time for the mock. It is time for the mock. Before I get into the mock, I want to remind you that Attic Records joins you in supporting WRCT. Yeah, Attic Records, located in Millville. They're open 7 days a week. They provide new and used records and CDs. They're family-owned and operated. They pay for quality used records and CDs. You can visit them in Millville, right there on Grant Street. Like, I almost like in the corner of, like, Lincoln and Grant, if I have my street names right. Or just call them up at 412-821-8484. And don't forget, if you're interested in underwriting for WRCT, you can email pr@wrct.org. Find out more information about promotional exchanges and other partnership opportunities. Let me find some appropriate background music as we are in the mock. Junior Parker, Mr. Blues, little Junior Parker, is going underneath the mock light. He died 51 years ago today. So I found a half dozen songs to play for you in tribute of Junior Parker. So these are songs that maybe he didn't write, but songs that he had the first recording and the first release of. That's how this one's working. That's how all the mocks work, for the most part. So it is a Junior Parker mock. If I can say Junior Parker mock, if I can say that correctly, that's what we're getting into. And we are starting things off with from their 1980 album, it's the Blasters. Coming back.
I'm gonna pull off my shoes, get on the floor, dance away my blues. I do the finger food rock, I do the finger food rock, I do the finger food rock, I'm gonna dance away the whole. Don't nobody boogie like me and you and
'cause I feel so good.
The Soft Boys, Robin Hitchcock, Kimberly Rue and company, doing their version of Mystery Train, wrapping up what I call the mock. This was a Junior Parker mock, a bunch of songs that he first put out and first released as done by other artists. But you know what was in that in the mock? Before the Soft Boys,
You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM.
Pittsburgh, you're tuned into From the Basement here on WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM. That was Star by Varg2TM from the Swedish artist's album from earlier this year, Nordic Flora Series Part 6, Outlaw Music. Up next, we've got Video Games 2 featuring Purple Sparkly Bentley from Detroit duo Snow Strippers from one of my favorites from this year, Night Killers Volume 2.
Video games. Through my mind.